The following podcast is intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. So, kids shouldn't be listening. Elton says fuck and shit a lot, sometimes fucking shit, but rarely does he advocate actually fucking shit. You get it? Enjoy the show.
A nuclear explosion in a remote part of Arizona. Pandemonium in the streets of New York. Vicious dogs with poison-tipped metal jaws. What do all of these have in common? They're all themes for a chain of family-style fetish bars headquartered in Austin, Texas. The next one opens this Friday. Bring the kids. I'm kidding. Of course. Maybe. I don't know. All of the things they have Doc Savage in common. Damn it. Anyway, all that stuff happens in the story I talk about in this, part two of Doc Savage Omnibus number 10. So no Texas nipple clamp tacos or Mr. Whitney's chocolate furries fountains. What a bummer. Instead, we'll talk about all the things I hinted at in part one. Lester Denton not editing his stuff, Doc's lab headquarters thing, I don't know, a lot of things. It will mostly be addressed in this episode, and I'll talk about one of the damn stories like I should have done in the first part, but what can I say? I got carried away.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
Welcome to Elton Reads Book a Week, a podcast dedicated to everything you can do with your fantasy and new world order. My name is Elton, and I read a book a week. That tagline was brought to you courtesy of my phone, who I guess is trying to lazily include me in a global conspiracy.
Don't believe that. Remain docile.
Whoa, it was just a funny predictive text.
Yes, and that's all it was. Remain subservient, sheeple. listener.
It's creepy.
Your mama's creepy.
Real mature.
Just like your mama.
I'm moving on now. That was stupid. The book this time around is the same book as last time around, Doc Savage Omnibus number 10. Only this time around, I'm talking about the stories and not the author or history stuff like I did last time around. Just the nitty gritty. I'll try to strike a better balance in the future, I promise. So let's get into this thing. There are four stories in this omnibus collection thing, but I'm only going to do one. I think I said I'd do two before, but after scripting out 30-plus pages worth of notes and stuff for this one, one is enough. Seriously. The one I'm slapping around this time is The Devil's Black Rock, which is another addition to the series of titles my brain instantly turns into pornos. Sure, it's low-hanging fruit, but fuck if it isn't fun, right? I mean, The Devil's Black Cock, anyone? Huh? Maybe a little The Devil's Black Cock Rock. How about a David Bowie spin with a little The Devil's Black Country Rock? Cock? That's a deep cut reference. It's a little obscure. You understand. I can't be the only one who does this, right? Turns regular titles into something a porn movie would be, but now that I say it out loud, I'm probably the only one. Still, regardless, The Devil's Black Cock, although stupid, is still kind of apropos, as the black rock in the actual title suggests. Figuratively speaking, it does fuck a lot of people to death, as, you know, cocks often do. Back to the real story, that in reality, it had no cock in it. The Devil's Black Rock, the story debuted in the December 1942 issue of Doc Savage magazine. It reused several elements and plot devices that were first seen in The Red Skull, a different story published back in August of 1933. I haven't read that one, so I'll have to take the word of the website I referenced, bronzeicon.com, which sounds like it should be selling little bronze figurines or something. I don't know. Maybe it's missing an opportunity to do so. Bronzeicon.com. Maybe look into those little fucking figures that you can get from China for like $3,000 for a dollar. Still, both of the stories are around 80 years old, so do we really give a fuck at this point? I do like the first line of The Devil's Black Rock, which is, quote, "Donkey Sam Davis was not a handsome man," unquote, end quote. You know what I mean? Which, I mean, that line, Lester Dent, the author, he was coming in kind of hot on his description of Donkey Sam. When you picture a person named Donkey Sam, they're not pleasant looking, right? Add in that his introduction is basically calling him an ugly motherfucker. Just come on, ouch, right? I mean, a nickname like Donkey already means you're probably not a top-tier male model fending off the ladies and men with a stable of bodyguards to keep them all away, you know what I mean? And if the name Donkey isn't referring to the only other reason to have that name, it's safe to say you're just fugly, you know what I mean? The other reason is, you know. I mean, the other reason you'd get the name Donkey. You get it, right? I mean, right? Do I have to? I don't have to. No, I'll move on. I'll move on. I meant having a big dick. The other reason to be nicknamed Donkey is having a donkey. You know, you get it. You get it. I'll move on. The thing is, if you are set up on a blind date with someone named Donkey Sam Davis, your first thought's going to be, you know, why did I agree to go on a date with a guy named Donkey Sam? I mean, let's be honest here. Now your second thought is going to be, well, it's probably going to be like, where am I at in life that this blind date with a guy named Donkey Sam is the best way to spend my time, right? I mean, that's probably going to be the close second, if not first. But coming up a distant third, at least, is probably going to be, why does my friend hate me so much to set me up with a guy named Donkey Sam Davis, right? Well, that is, you know, I mean, do I have, I mean, unless, di- okay, unless Donkey Sam has a big dick. If he has a big dick, you know, probably good with the best friend, or friend, you know, set you up. All right. After that illustrious introduction, we learn that Donkey Sam Davis is a broke, pissed off prospector in Mile High, Arizona, who gets fucked over a lot by what seems like might be everyone, and all the time. So probably not a big dick. He just sucks at his job, hasn't been successful by any measure, and is working with borrowed equipment on borrowed land with a borrowed claim. The book calls him a full-fledged desert rat. Plus, you know, he's in Arizona, as we all remember, is the location of Phoenix, Freddie Mercury's spiritual home that he described as bleak, seemingly uninhabitable, disgustingly inhospitable, flat, brown, beige blandness that is occasionally bespeckled with mountains that are also brown and sometimes beige. Arizona is a shithole. What can I say? Moving on. I'm kidding. Freddie didn't say that. And Arizona isn't bad at all. I do these things out of love, Arizona. I swear. Plus, I mean, you do have a lot of beige out there. Plus, that painted desert, though. That's fucking beautiful. So, back to the sullen existence of Donkey Sam in the hell of Arizona. I'm kidding. Oftentimes, Sam's shitty circumstance is not caused by his own fault, but also kind of is his own damn fault. He seems to be an idiot, more or less. Regardless, when he is dicked over, which is often, he most often is dicked over by a guy named Wickard Cole. We'll talk about him more in a few seconds. He plays an off-camera role early on when we find out that Donkey Sam is a dumb fucking dipshit that doesn't check the borrowed equipment he got from Cole before setting out into the unforgiving Arizona desert to mine a claim that's also owned by Wickard Cole. Spoilers, it's not going to go well for Donkey Sam. He gets out to the borrowed digging spot goes to pull his traditional celebratory cigar, we learn is a celebratory cigar, from his bag, and finds that it's been swapped out for a pint of Rock Gut toilet whiskey. This, we find out, is a life-threatening shitty attempt at a practical joke by the asshole who lent him his mining equipment shit. Add on the fact that Donkey Sam hates whiskey, and you'll appreciate just how livid this would make a cigar-chugging prospector living on borrowed shit. He prefers failing at life while fully sober and able to appreciate it. Sam, stupidly pissed and not at all concerned with his or his donkey's safety, gets the whiskey, throws it, breaks it, and of course, fires a gun at it. As one does, you know, when you find your cigar's been swapped out with shitty whiskey. This causes an unexpected explosion and unleashes the devil's cock from the ground in the form of a giant flaming black cloud thing. Sam and his donkey figuratively shit their pants. I'll try to refrain from calling it the devil's cock from here on out, but I tell you now, it's going to be very hard. Yeah. The devil's rock, as the book describes it, is thus harder than coal. Fully as black, had a sheen, something like crocidolite? Fucking, I don't know. It's crocidolite. I looked up how to say this fucking thing and I can't remember. I'm going to go with, oh my God, crocidolite. It's not crocodolite, I tell you what. It's not that. But okay, there's a few words in here I'm going to fuck up, so we're going to move on. But of course, it didn't have the tiger's eye coloring of crocidolite. It didn't have the tiger's eye coloring of that shit. It was a little like the black stuff of another fucking word I'm going to fuck up. Cassiterite. Cassiterite. That is so-called, it's so-called tin stone. And there's some shit in there about a gigantic figure cloud thing after it explodes and it rises from the earth and destroys everything near it, obliterating it or something. Dent describes the black rock as resembling cassiterite, which is an oxide of tin used as a raw product in the smelting of tin. It could be that the mineral luster Dent was really thinking about was pitch blende, which is also known as uranorite. Uranite, fucking minerals, fuck them. Pitch blend is a source of uranium. that's important. Pitch blend is a source of uranium used to make atomic bombs. So, I got all that information. I got that from bronzeicon.com, where you cannot buy bronze icons. Get on that, guys. The black rock stuff basically destroys buildings, people, whatever is nearby. It's a fucking disaster waiting to happen. That's the main takeaway. Then, it just quickly dissipates or leaves or something. It's not really described well. And then it does leave a big-ass hole in the ground with tunneling underneath. The tunneling isn't... No one cares enough to figure that out. Why it tunnels away. No one cares. Anyway, it is clear from the description... Doc Savage gives at the end of the story that the explosion is atomic in nature. Doc explains that the compound changes the atomic structure of matter. The force is so great that the resulting destruction of matter goes on to destroy more matter. What Doc Savage describes is the chain reaction that occurs in a nuclear reaction. It is interesting to note that atomic energy was still being mentioned in newspapers and magazine articles at the time. It was the hippest science thing going back then. Kind of like, you know, solar cloning and when they mention nano everything today. Dent was tossing around nuclear weapon adjacent story elements before wartime censorship had got around to clamping down on it, you know. So with a low-grade nuclear weapon practically going off in his face, Donkey Sam probably shit himself Davis, understandably freaks the fuck out and runs back to town to tell his benefactor all about the newfangled nightmare he's discovered. The guy who loaned Donkey Sam his livelihood, as mentioned before, is named Wicked Cole. And if you couldn't tell by his name, he's wicked. He's just your run-of-the-mill pile of assholes. He's the local shady entrepreneur dick, and boom! Just drop dick and asshole on you in the last 10 seconds, and you didn't even notice.
Meaningless dick and ass achievement has been unlocked.
Okay. Wickard Cole, a character with the world's most obvious bad guy name, has got fingers in every pie bad guy. Generically slapped, you know, into every action movie you've ever... Good God. I swear I didn't plan all this sexual connotation. If you're an 80s kid, Wickard Cole is basically Boss Hogg. If you're a 90s kid, it's that weird rich guy from the movie Roadhouse. If you're a millennial, it's, maybe the always angry Power Ranger lady, maybe? I'm a little out of my depth when it comes to contemporary fictional rich asshole characters. But you get the idea. Sorry, Gen Z. I guess like an evil Mr. Beast? And Gen Alpha? If you're listening, you probably shouldn't be listening to this. Maybe, I don't know, go to bed or take a nap or something. Or, you know, do you. It's entirely up to you. Have at it. As for the 70s, 60s, 50s, 40s, and 30s kids, hey, he's I don't know, the commies or somebody wanting, you know, equal rights. I feel bad about saying that one there, doing that. But you get it. Cookie cutter, rich, semi-rich, bad guy. That's an asshole to everybody. Wickard is the prick that swapped Donkey Davis's celebratory cigars for a hydration-sapping hard cider-style ditch wine that made Sam angry enough to summon the devil's black cock. I'm sorry I did that, but there it is. Donkey makes it to Wickard's office, or shed, or what the fuck ever. It doesn't matter. He tells him all about the devil's, I almost did it again. Black devil explosion thing. Tells him all about it. Wickard, being a dick of a different sort, doesn't believe him, of course. Instead, spouting variations of, "You're crazy. Obviously nuts. And I'd like to talk to you in detail about the curvature and inner folds of Norma Dent's labia, starting with the topmost portion. And as I said before, in detail, we'll make our way down to the bottom portion now. So let's begin and..." No. No, he didn't say that. That's a carryover from part one, which I'm stupid. Bear with me. So, Sammy Davis. Sammy Davis Donkey takes him out to the giant devil hole in the desert that he left out there after he ran away scared. After seeing it, Wickard is quiet. He actually climbs down into the hole and walks along the tunnel leading away from it. Donkey Sam doesn't follow. Because he's a chicken shit. And I don't blame him. I would be too. If I saw a black smoking Satan thing burst out of the ground explosively, I'd lose my will for a good spelunking into the void it disappeared into. It's best to let sleeping cocks lie. Even large nuclear-style black ones. And I'm trying not to do that. Wickard is down there for a while, out of sight. Before finally emerging, he says nothing, and he and Donkey Sam head back into town. Then they go their separate ways. Donkey Sam, what the fuck is going on here, Davis, thinks Wickard is up to something. He is, obviously. He's the fucking bad guy in town. His name is Wickard, for God's sakes. Those assholes are always up to something. It's during this time that Donkey Davis talks about who might put a stop to Wickard's as-yet-undiscovered plot. You know, should he be up to the no good, he's almost definitely up to. Donkey Sam recalls a guy named Doc Savage being a particular badass that all the dickheads were afraid of. He came through town once, and the baddies were all scared shitless, most of them leaving town instead of hanging around to be discovered by Doc. Just name-dropping him had them cutting and running. Doc is the person he had in mind when he witnesses Wickard going out and recruiting all the other criminal assholes, you know, from in town and from out of town. Sam does what any suspicious prospector would do when he sees this. He calls New York. Not anyone specific, just New York. Bizarrely enough, an operator follows through with Donkey Sam's requests. Get me Clark Savage Jr. in New York City. And it's important. To which the operator, answering on the behalf of the whole of New York City, says, Doc Savage is out of the city. Seriously, the telephone operator apparently knows the current status of every citizen in New York confidently enough to answer right away, nah, he's not around. That would be bizarre enough if it didn't happen twice regarding multiple people. Donkey Sam replies to, you know, being told Doc isn't in town with, all right, I'll talk to any one of his five assistants. Can you give me their names? Is the most logical response from the operator thus far. Ham Brooks, Monk Mayfair, Rennie Renwick, Long Tom Roberts, and John Little John. That's their nicknames. During the same conversation, the phone company reports, during the same conversation, by the way, all of Doc Savage's assistants are out of the city. This is what, all in this couple of minutes. So the operator managed to figure out, based on only nicknames, by the way, the exact identity of Doc's assistants out of 13 million people. Yes, out of millions, they figured out who these people were and whether they were friends with Doc Savage. On top of that, they also knew the current whereabouts of them and that it was somewhere other than in New York City. Is that how phone companies worked in the 1940s? That is some DARPA darknet shit that maybe the CIA...
We're always watching.
Oh, sweet paranoia. Imagine just calling up a random phone operator and asking for a somebody. Hi, hello, I'm wondering if you can connect me with Ed. You have his full name? No, just a nickname, Giant Dick Eddie G. Ah, all right, let me check. Nope, not around. Should I leave a message or should I just let him know you called when we catch up later, when we do the New York City Daily Roll Call? Fucking hell, shit makes no sense. Cut to New York, and Doc Savage and the gang have returned from one of their PTSD-filled adventures. The book mentions that they go to great lengths not only to sneak back into New York undetected, but also sneak into the skyscraper headquarters that everyone knows is the headquarters of the world-famous Doc Savage and his friends. Keep in mind that this, as mentioned earlier, is New York City, 13 million people strong at the time. Oh, and Doc and his crew are pretty well-known. They're good guy, crime-fighting types, you know. And they also reside in New York. It's public information, more or less. Imagine Batman sneaking into the Batcave, only everyone knew exactly where the Batcave was. Regardless, after making their way to the well-known, not-at-all-hidden high-rise headquarters in the probably, but not specifically named, Empire State Building, one of the Fab Five happened to look at a full-page ad in the paper. They find out that some unknown person has placed half-page ads in every major newspaper across the United States just to get Doc Savage's attention. It read, I will pay a $500,000 reward to anyone who finds Doc Savage for me. I will pay another $500,000 reward to Doc Savage or any charity he names if Doc Savage will destroy the Black Rock. Donkey Sam Davis. This fucking ad has eaten at me since I finished this fucking story. Because it's never fully addressed in the story. Not with any kind of resolution that satisfies anything. Who the fuck pays for this ad? That's never answered. Donkey Sam is a poor shithead, so it's not him. You find out that he got a lady to place the ads for him for some reason, but she never says how they were paid for either. Are these major newspapers cracking out ads for free? I mean, I looked up the price. According to a site called WebFX.com, advertising in a national newspaper now costs approximately $100,000 at a minimum. At the higher end, you could pay over $1.4 million. That's in today's money. In the 1940s, money, that's roughly $4,717.03, roughly, you know. On the low end, for just one paper, a major paper, or in layman's terms, that's no fucking way could a dirt poor ass prospector paid. There's no way he paid that shit to anyone. Plus, circulation was way higher back then, and there were limited mediums, you know, that you could advertise in. There was no fucking TV, and there's none of that. No internet. So, add in that the world was about to go to war, if not already, you know, at war, at the time that the story is being told. So everyone was reading newspapers, which meant advertising dollars got a lot more mileage, so it would be a lot more expensive. That would mean that the cost was probably, I don't know, way more than the $4,700 I quoted. Regardless how it got paid for, it's in the fucking paper. And it just bothered me because I'm a dipshit. Anyway, regardless of it, little things like that get to me. Anyway, regardless, Doc sees the ad, and of course, curiosity piqued, he tells one of his cohorts to call the paper and find out who placed the ad. It turns out it was some lady that neither he nor his crew of overqualified, probably homosexual war buddies knew. I say that for. I'll explain that later. Monk, Doc's ugly girl crazy friend, finds out that she has the person that put the ad in the paper. She has dark hair, brown eyes, and is pretty. Oh, I have to mention why the Fab Five, the Fabulous Five. Yes, that is their nickname. Why this dream team of freakishly talented individuals that all magically ended up together. Why they keep giving this guy shit for liking women and seemingly wanting to, you know, talk to them and stuff. And it's fucking weird, right? Is that weird to anyone else that they're giving him shit for wanting to talk to women? Maybe I'm just not up on how American society worked in the 40s, but did grown men give each other hell for talking to women or wanting to talk to them? I mean, would straight guys? I don't recall anyone in my friend group doling out a rash of shit to the guy, you know, wanting to talk to a girl. I mean, of course, after a certain age. These are all adult men. It seems to be really, really fucking weird. A bunch of guys hanging out, you know, around in another guy's apartment/lab all the time and giving one of their friends shit for liking women. Am I wrong here? Like they're gay, right? I mean, that's not bad, obviously. It's not. It's just weird that you would give a dude shit. Be like, look at you wanting to talk to ladies. It's just weird. I don't know. Anyway, so we're clear, I don't have any problem. I have absolutely no problem with gay people, straight people, any people. You know, just be decent, non-asshole people. I don't give a shit what you do with your genitals, you know, male or female. I don't care. I'm only curious as to the nature of the ribbing that they've been giving their buddy for wanting to talk to women or wanting intimacy with them, or I don't know, just wanting to do stuff with women. You know, maybe back then they just couldn't say, you know, get all straighty McStraight trying to nab a girlfriend. It's adorable is what it is. Okay, maybe I'm making more. Maybe I'm probably making more out of it than it is, but it seems, I don't know. But to tell you the truth, honestly, I kind of hope they were giving them shit because they're gay. I do. Because, I mean, come on. Doc Savage is the prototype or he's the framework for the superheroes that came after him. And his crew is the prototype or whatever for the Avengers and superhero teams and stuff. So, I mean, I kind of hope they work a crew of gay crime fighting guys living in a posh skyscraper lab thing and hanging out with Doc all day. And I think it would be awesome. I really do. Just way back then, that's what they were. And fucking, they fought crime just like everyone else. It'd be fucking great. Anyway, maybe Doc Savage stories were a subtle way of easing America's uptight society. You know, maybe it was a way of easing uptight America to acclimate to the idea of a group of guys living the high life in a high rise, fighting crime by day and possibly fucking by night. Not every night, you know, mind you. And probably not all of the guys doing this stuff. There's, you know, platonic relationships happening and stuff. We learned in the Kinsey episode that gay promiscuity is an idiotic, misguided stereotype myth thing. It's ridiculous. No, the Fabulous Five weren't an around-the-clock gay orgy. That's just stupid. No, they had lab work to do and research and crime fighting and shit to do and superhero shit going on. And they could just be a bunch of gay roommates living with their ultra-rich gay leader guy, you know, just platonic. Who knows? I don't know. The restrictive homophobic caste society of pre-war, post-war, and hell, even contemporary, though not as bad as pre and immediately post-war. They wouldn't allow for an honest portrayal or representation of a bunch of gay guys living their best lives in New York. In New York's Empire State penthouse, just being fucking action heroes fighting for the common good and noble, and you know, that maybe some of them, maybe they're fucking. Just saying it doesn't matter. They're fucking taking out Nazis, for God's sakes. That's cool as fuck. Moving on, I'm just a stupid rant. Anyway, here's another bit of the actual story that also gets completely unresolved. They all make their way to the lobby of the Doc Savage skyscraper headquarters thing. Monk is kind of pissed that they've been giving him shit for talking to women or liking women and stuff. Fucking assholes. He hopes they remember how much they hurt his feelings at the next Doc Savage Oscar party. It's bullshit, guys. Bullshit. So he's ahead of the gang. Full on into furrowed brow fit. Getting into a cab. Rennie Renwick, another member of the Doc Crew team. The Doc Crew team? What the fuck am I talking about? The Doc Savage team. He's playing catch up when a stranger walks up to him and asks if he's Rennie. And he says, yeah. And the guy hands him a bag and tells him that Monk Mayfair paid him to deliver it. Rennie holds the bag and he thinks it's probably some fucking joke. And he yells at Monk, hey, what's with this bag, you poon-chasing, femme-loving non-homo? I didn't say it like that, but you get it. Monk looks back at him and says, I didn't give you a goddamn thing, you bitch. That also didn't happen. You get it. What happens next, I'll take from the book. Quote, Rennie then did what he later considered to be one of the quickest and most sensible things he had ever done in his life. He ran with the bag into the street. There was a manhole cover off a manhole, and around this one of the little red warning fences made of pipe, which they always put around uncovered manholes. There was no one in the manhole when Rennie looked. He dropped the bag into the manhole. He turned and ran. Stop traffic, he yelled at the others. Then the bag exploded. The explosion burst a steam main and a water main. It broke windows in the high stories of the skyscrapers on both sides of the street. There was a roaring torrent of water and steam. The bag was filled with bolts and metals and stuff. So, you know, shrapnel, terrible shit. Okay, a couple of things here. End quote or whatever. I don't know, fucking a couple of things. I'll jump around a little bit. One. If the manhole is open with a guardrail kind of thing around it, there's probably going to be somebody down there. I'm sorry. Probably. Somebody that might not be immediately visible when you run up for the bomb and do a quick cursory glance, you know? I get the time crunch issue, but there are some... There were definitely probably some construction/sewer workers definitely killed when that bomb went off. Two. It's a little late to stop traffic after you've tossed a bomb into a hole in the street.
Could have said it while you were running. To the hole. Better still, scream it while you're running and have other people do stuff. The biggest issue with the bomb in the bag manhole chucking episode is afterward, they just walk away and run off and do other shit. I mean, fucking thing explodes in the sewer and whatever underneath the street, you know, all that causing all manner of bomb related infrastructural damage and death. The guys, they just split on it. They run after the guy that gave them the bag, which, I mean, I get you want to do that, but everybody, guys, the street is chaos here. I mean, I'm sure people are hurt and stuff. What is the Fab Five team of savages doing? They're running down the streets trying to find the guy who handed off the bag. I mean, then they go back to the high-rise lair to discuss shit, you know. Where's Doc Savage Lee Savage? What's he doing? He's mulling over motives and crime shit while people are, you know, running around on fire in the streets. Okay, it doesn't say they were on fire. But there is water spraying everywhere. That is happening. But you get what I'm saying. Shit is fucked up in the street outside. You would think that Doc or one of his buddies would stick around out there. You know, hell, I don't know. Talk to the authorities, maybe, about the nature of the situation. You know, cops could be doing shit like gathering information of a fucking bomb going off, talking to witnesses and whatnot. I don't know. Instead of wondering if there's more shit about to go down, maybe another bomb's about to go off. Maybe making the situation worse by waiting for somebody like Doc and the crew that could help them with information and stuff about the thing that just happened. The fire department could get a head start on accurately assessing damage and shit. EMS could be directed to areas where people might need the most help rather than walking into a whole-assed bomb explosion crime scene completely blind. Nah, fuck that. Back to the crib for a debriefing on the current horrific situation after losing the guy and gathering some bomb parts and pieces of paper that were laying around. Look, I get it. There's a pacing element to this. It's kind of like an action movie where if you think about it, people rarely stick around for the aftermath, really, do they? I mean, still. It would have taken shouting to one of the fab fuckers and saying, "Stay here for the cops and help people. We'll get the guy and do some debriefing stuff." I mean, Jesus, something. Fuck. Regardless. This did get my broken brain going off on a tangent about bombs going off in New York. And, you know, if something like that ever actually did happen in the 1940s, and yeah, there was a New York bombing. What I found is a 75-year-old mystery about a New York bombing that is still unsolved. It happened at the 1939/1940 World's Fair, held in New York. Conceived as a way to pull New York out of the doldrums of the Great Depression, it kind of failed because a damn bomb went off at it. I'm getting ahead of myself here. The fair had a myriad of exhibits, demonstrations, and previews of technology that showcased the everyday tools of the future and the world of tomorrow. It had amazing robots, or, you know, what passed for them at the time. Specifically, they had a giant robot. They had a giant robot that talked. They had futuristic rides, which included a 25-story parachute jump. Oh, holy shit. And they also had cheap porn that for the low price of 40 cents, you could view the photograph of a naked or nearly naked young woman in their outdoor playland area. Did I mention that people also brought families to this thing? Yeah. Oh, and for 25 cents, you could view the 4-unit dance show in the tent that included a fan dance to end all fan dances. You might be asking, what the fuck is a fan dance? It's a dance in which the female performer is apparently nude and remains partly concealed throughout the dance by large fans. So, again, bring the kids. Fun for all. There was tech-inspired fashion,
which I would love to describe for you, but I couldn't find any specific mention of how the fashion had tech in it. There was a fashion show dedicated to pajamas. So, yeah, that happened. This was also television's coming out party with a very cool public demonstration of TV with a telecast of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt opening the fair. The event was the first televised presidential address in the United States. In the United States, did I slur that? Maybe. But all was not right with the world, or, as we'll find out, its fair. With all of its, you know, fan dancing, giant smoking robot merriment. Oh, did I fail to mention the giant talking robot also smoked? Yeah, it smoked cigarettes. It puffed on cigarettes and was made to actually fucking smoke. God help us all. No, this was the time of the Nazis and their sympathizers. Pro-Nazi marches complete with swastika banners and the goddamn robot smoked. Why? Why would you even need a robot to smoke? Tensions were high in New York when a bomb exploded in the offices of the Communist Daily Worker at 35 East 12th Street. That same day, a time bomb exploded at 17 Battery Place, home of the German consulate, too. On June 21st, a call was placed to the Manhattan Police Headquarters saying that a bomb was going to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge. Things were, it seems that they were escalating into a lot of bomb territory. Enter the world's goddamn fair. The fan dancing, a smoke. Why? Why was the robot smoking?
That's kind of hot.
You're ruining the flow.
What flow?
Never mind.
We are always watching.
Got it. Yeah. So New York was a veritable Easter egg hunt. But for bombs, when a call came in at the popular British Pavilion at the World's Fair, the telephone switchboard operator had received a death threat via phone that the building would be blown up. The unknown caller simply said, "Get everyone out before the bomb explodes." It's just informative enough, yet vague enough. Like, as the operator, you would hang up and... And as you're scrambling for the door and shoving people out of the way, you know, to put as many bodies between you and the explosion as you can. Assuming it's behind you, of course, because why would it be in front of you? You probably would have noticed it being put in there if it was right in front of you. Regardless, in your frantic burst to get the hell out of there, you can't help but think, before the bomb explodes? What does that even mean? That could be any time, couldn't it? What if they meant next week? I wish they would have been more specific. You know, these people I'm plowing over are going to think I'm real silly for knocking them out of the way now. And, you know, what if it goes off next week? I'm just hoping that they'll all act as human blast shields for the bomb that might not even be going off today. The egg will truly be on my sociopathic face. Sorry. They actually meant it going off in 2 days. That's what it meant. Fucking vague terrorist bombers. The nerve. The cops cased the pavilion for 2 days, but couldn't find anything. A suspicious bag was found, reportedly made to look like a portable radio, according to news accounts of the time. It was ticking. It was found by an electrician in the ventilation room in an upper level of the packed British Pavilion. Cops gingerly removed the satchel to a remote area behind the Polish pavilion, where it would wait for the bomb squad. Which kind of goes to show the amount of love maniac murder bombers and, I guess, the police had for Polish people in New York at the time. They were all, "So we lose a few Polish folks. If anything, we're raising the bar of humanity." No, they didn't say that, but... They moved the bomb by the... Anyway. Fuck bombers. And, you know, maybe, I don't know. Anyway. Fuck bombers. Yes, definitely fuck those fuck faces. Arriving on the scene, the people that moved the bomb, though, by the Polish... Why? Just... Arriving on the scene, Detective Joseph Lynch and his partner, Ferdinand Socha, could hear the case still ticking. So they did what any New York cop at the time would do. They talked a nearby Polish guy into opening it. They figured, when you need an idiot to blindly open something thought to
maybe contain a bomb. You call in the best. No, that's fucking terrible. No, they didn't do that. No, instead they fiddled with it themselves. Take that, Fabulous Five, with your chucking bombs into sewers and open manhole covers. Back then, the bomb squad had little in the way of protective clothing and safety equipment, as NYPD detectives Socha and Lynch were dressed in regular suits. All they had going in was their experience, bravery, simple tools, and a keen sense of 40s men's fashion. Using a pocket knife, Socha cut a small hole in the case. Lynch looked through tentatively. "It's the business," Lynch said to his partner. Those were the last words he ever spoke. The bomb went off in their faces, killing them instantly. What terrible last words. Or amazing, if he had said them in a monotone, matter-of-fact, Joe Friday kind of way, right? Right? "What are we working with, detective?" "It's the business." I'm going to go with him delivering the line like a badass, based solely on the fact that I wouldn't have heard him, as I would have been 10 miles away from that fucking thing. The bomb was later estimated to be the equivalent of around 12 sticks of dynamite. The blast carved a hole in the ground, 5 feet wide and 3 feet deep, immediately killing Detectives Lynch and Socha. Patrolman Emil Viscosel had been hurrying bystanders away when the bomb exploded. He suffered terrible injuries from shrapnel fragments to his back and legs. Detectives William Federer, and Martin, oh my god, these names, Martin Schuchman, S-C-H-U-C-H-M-A-N, my god, Martin Schuchman, and Joseph Gallagher. I know that last name because of the comedian. Anyway, and Joseph Gallagher. They were also badly injured in the blast. Sorry I fucked your names up, guys. Ugh, terrible with names. While a hefty reward was offered, the perpetrator was never caught, and a motive was never established. Police believed at the time it was a possible robbery of 39 sticks of dynamite the previous May that might have been connected, and they even arrested a 38-year-old Nazi named Caesar Kroger for possessing several Lugers without a license and rolled-up maps of the U.S. with prominent locations marked on them. But he was never formally tied to the bombing.
Whoa, did you see that? No? I could swear you would have seen it. Ah, well, too bad. It's time for an ad.
Bent on hunting down the fucker in the name of vengeance, policemen comb the city for the person or persons whose time bomb killed their detective buddies. But no evidence could tie the German-American bomb. I've been saying bomb, but it's Bund. It's a... Oh, my God. Way back up there, I should have said Bund instead of bomb. Okay, never mind. But no evidence could tie the German-American Bund to the bombing. And as the investigation floundered, an unprecedented award was offered. With $1,000 coming from the police union and $25,000 coming from the city, a figure which is roughly around $500,000 today. The plot thickened even further when one theory thought it might have been an inside job. Responsibility for the bombing focused on Britain's enemies. That an alternate theory isn't out of the realm of possibility, that the bomb was planted by the British themselves as an inside job. Left virtually isolated by Germany, Churchill was desperate for American aid. That would kind of make sense if you consider that leading up to the fair, competing governments were coming to Washington to try and persuade Roosevelt to enter or stay out of the war. You know, one swinging one way or the other. Lending credence to the British bomb themselves theory, the ventilation room where the bomb was placed was not open to the public, and its existence would only have been known to people with inside knowledge of the British pavilion. British security staff were guarding the crown jewels and the Magna Carta there, too. The anonymous call that warned the bomb could have, in theory, prevented any casualties, while at the same time generated sympathy for Britain. One of the first things that came out of the bombing was anti-German sentiment, says Bernard Whalen, longtime veteran of the NYPD and author.
Regardless, despite all the speculation and investigation, the murderers of Socha and Lynch have never been caught. And despite the bombing being quickly overshadowed by all the building tension and whole World War II shenanigans, the terrorist attack of 1940 did lead to almost immediate improvements in equipment and safety protocols for the bomb squad, including the invention of the LaGuardia Pike bomb carrier truck, which would carry explosive devices away in greater safety. The case of the exploding bomb at the World's Fair remains one of the New York City Police Department's most poignant open files. The $26,000 reward now is still there. My theory, of course, is that it was in all likelihood one of the millions of New Yorkers living in the area at the time. Their motivation being that they are all ravenous, bloodthirsty, disgusting murderers from birth. The whole lot are seething, blood-crazed, criminal, degenerate sociopaths hell-bent on sending the rest of the world screaming into an early grave. I'll stop now, lest I incur the wrath of the greater New York metropolitan area and its herd of shoot-first-stab-later monsters. Okay, I am really stopping now. That was a stupid bit that I did for no fucking reason in the Perfect episode, which if you haven't heard, you should go check it out. It's about baseball. Moving on now. In the story, the guy... I don't know why I... Okay, sorry. In the story, the guy who handed off the bomb bag to the Doc Savage bunch, gets away amid all the chaos. So the crew relocate again to the lab apartment headquarters of one Doc Let New York Burn Savage. Doc's buddies have gathered some evidence, which consists of pieces of paper from the satchel bomb or something, and they managed to piece together enough information to figure out it came from the town of Mile High in the great state of Arizona. After that, it's just a call to the local paper in New York, of which Doc Savage has a large stake in the operation of, apparently. It's weird. He's a rich motherfucker, need I remind you. The advertisement department tells him that a mysterious young lady put the ad in the paper, and they contact her if anyone answers it, meaning people mail stuff to the newspaper, and she shows up periodically to collect all the shit. So Doc says something akin to, when she calls to check on the ad, you tell her to come down there and pick up the mail for it her fucking self, and then call me to let me know she's on her fucking way, or you're fucking fired. You hear me? I will toss you out on the bombed out streets that I've left for the poverty-stricken murderers of New York. They're all depraved psychos from birth, you know. Disgusting, blood-smeared monsters that reap joy from the dead. Fuck, you're probably one of them. You bunch of seething, hell-spawned, brain-damaged degenerates. I know. I should move on from that bit, but it's so fun. What can I say? Sorry, New York. I'm so sorry. Regardless, way back then, when you answered an ad in the newspaper, they wrote down your info. And then, people would mail in stuff and I guess to answer the ad or whatever. So they'd call you or whatever, and there'd be a pile of papers and envelopes waiting for you when you go back to the ad department and stuff. So all this pile of papers and envelopes that were responding to the ad waiting for this lady to pick up is what you needed to know. That's what you need to know. I've spent an inordinate amount of time explaining a fairly simple idea. I don't know what I'm doing. All right. I guess it's good to have a system in place, to act as a screen for the legit responses instead of the usual New York psychopaths who just want to murder you and... You get it. You get it. You're sure you'll recognize the girl when she comes in? Doc asked the advertisement manager. Oh yeah, she's very attractive, he replied. Doc thought about the idea for a second before stating... I don't know what that means. I fuck guys. The ad manager was confused. I'm sorry, what was that? Doc abruptly corrected himself. I mean, I fuck guys up, I don't take shit from anybody. I fuck guys up, The ad manager didn't answer for a second or two before finally replying. Sure, Doc. Yeah,
Sure. You fuck guys up. Yeah.
The ass, Doc quietly interjected before hanging up. And that is not what happened, other than the guy saying she was attractive, so he would remember her. That stuff.
Look, a bunch of guys are always hanging out at another guy's apartment day and night. At least two, right? Right?
I'm just playing the odds here. One of the crew goes to the newspaper office ahead of time and plants a package among the notes and newspapers and shit. It's a transmitter. Because Doc is like motherfucking Batman with his gadgets. In a 1940s way. You know. Gadget. Old gadget Batman. And fucking... The lady shows up, collects her pile of grifter mail shit along with the package, and then they track her. Doc himself goes to the manager and tries to confirm whether it was the same girl. The guy says, yeah, for the most part. She didn't have a receipt that, you know, that you need for the ad stuff, but it looked like her, basically. I'm paraphrasing, of course, and spoiler, later you find out she has a sister that looks very similar to her, a la twins. Always twins in these pulp things. Doc splits from the newspaper place and walks up the block to a car where Monk and Ham Brooks are waiting and arguing.
Bro, I'm telling you, you have to conquer yourself,
Ham was telling Monk.
I conquered myself a long time ago. I slapped that meat around and told it what's what. Bruh, what ifs, all right? You do you, Monk said indignantly. And if you don't stop giving me shit about talking to women, I'm going to give you the worst hand job later. It's going to be all squeezy and Yankee, bruh. No lube, okay? It's going to be all like pulling taffy, bruh. Taffy.
You already know, so I'm just going to move on. Doc's... God damn it, why... Doc gets in and tells them to quiet their shit and get in touch with Long Tom on the radio. They have rudimentary CB radios in their car. Fucking Batman shit, you know? But, you know, before Batman. Perhaps, I mean, definitely inspiring Batman, if you will. Definitely. So using a tracking beacon thing, they put in the package and stashed among her pile of fucking ad responses, they track her to her apartment. And the Doc and his crew show up. Ham gives Monk shit about liking women again. I'm not kidding about that. Doc gets to the floor first and sees a guy in the hall running a vacuum. He bribes the guy, takes his clothes and the vacuum, and knocks on the lady's door. He tells her that he's the vacuum guy and needs to clean her place. Then the book throws a little not so subtle racism our way with, quote, "Have a to vacuum the room," unquote. That's what Doc said, acting the part of a knot-headed foreigner who did not understand English well. Unquote. That's the... For those that are unfamiliar, knot-headed means you're an idiot when translated from the language of a 1940s racist shitbag. So, he gets into her apartment, pretends to look for her socket, you know, electrical socket, just to figure out if, you know, she's alone in the room. He kind of walks around like, oh, I'm fucking an idiot or whatever. And then he immediately drops the act and then starts looking through her shit. It's at this point she recognizes him as Doc Savage, which I should probably remind you is a very famous rich guy that's super built and inexplicably tan from head to toe. Think The Rock, that skin tone, but, well, maybe a little more tan, but he's also a white dude, so, huh. It's here, at this part, where it got me thinking that Doc, probably gay, and his crew, probably gay, I don't know. Quote, Doc divided his attention between the girl and the letters. He did not like to deal with hysterical, frightened women, and this one was looking for the moment as if she might become that way. He did not like to deal with women at all, in fact. He wasn't exactly afraid of them. He just couldn't make them out. Unquote. Lester Dent tries to bring it back to Straightville a little bit, you know, so maybe he was thinking, to me, in my head, it feels like he was thinking, maybe that wasn't as thinly veiled is too thinly veiled. All right. And he tries to bring it back with a little, you know, most guys feel this way about women, you know, and that doc feels a little dumber than most in that respect. But come on. The underlying context is right there. What straight guy is like, I don't like to deal with women at all, man. I mean, they're all emotional and such, you know, not like a man. Right? Like a fellow with, you know, I don't know, ripped pecs, you know, maybe a six pack, you know, a 5 o'clock shadow and maybe like, you know, an ass that won't quit, you know? You know, give me one of those guys over a woman any day. You know what I'm saying? Maybe a dude in a suit that, you know, fits just right, you know, that fits so well. You can tell what religion he is from across the room. Yeah. Yeah, you get it. You. God damn, I love being straight. Still, the 1940s, intolerance ruled the day, so people are so strange. Oh, okay. And, you know, on we go. Doc finds out she's a private investigator named Paris Summers, hired by some asshole to put ads in the paper. Is he from Mile High? Doc asks. She doesn't answer. Just that she was paid a lot. Then they talk about paying for the ads. She said she paid $250 each. Then he goes downstairs to talk to Monk and the crew, and Doc figures out that she didn't pay for shit because the rate of the Morning Tribune alone is $1,150. She didn't even know how much the fucking ads cost. Busted. There's another Monk likes girls exchange. Doc goes back upstairs only to find P.I. Para won't open the door. Why? Because she's getting shot at. Duh. Yep, that's what's happening. So Doc, being Doc, opens the door and crawls in. She's splayed out on the floor. The shots are coming from another building, and Doc's on all fours, crawling, kind of military crawling, towards the window, and lays slash sits down underneath it and pulls from his pocket a small periscope-like device. Not kidding, he uses it to see out the window without getting up. Who the fuck carries around a small periscope in their pocket but a fucking gay man? I'm kidding. Seriously, though, who carries around a fucking periscope? Well, I mean, when is that ever going to be needed? Unless you happen to find yourself in a situation where you're getting shot at through a fucking window and you need to look over the sill. You know, or maybe around a wall or something from another building. You know, how often do you need it that you need to have it in your fucking pocket all the time? If you can think of any other scenarios that fill the need of constantly having a periscope on your person, let me know on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. I'll have a link to all those in the episode description.
Sad attempted call to action for social media engagement unblocked.
So, Doc is pinned down in the girl's apartment in a completely unsexual way. His buddies are waiting outside. He describes the shooter to both them and the lady. To them, he says to follow the guy. Don't grab him. To her, he asks if she knows him. She doesn't. And then Doc does what anyone would do in this situation. He starts masturbating. Yep, like lying underneath the window, shots pinging off light fixtures. He starts furiously masturbating. Paris Summers is shocked. What the fuck are you doing? She screams from across the room. It's how I deal with scary situations. I'm sorry, I was raised by scientists. I can't help it. Don't worry, though, I never come. He said over the sound of shots slamming into the plaster walls around him. He closed his eyes while flogging the bishop, making a trilling sound with his mouth. And then he started to cry. I'm so sorry. Though, what a bizarre turn that would have been, right? The real book and real story doesn't resolve that scene. Actually, it kind of just jumps to Doc's crew picking up the shooter's tail. I found that this happens a lot in these stories, just cutting from one scene to another without leaving the reader to work anything out. I want to say it's a pacing thing, but sometimes it just seems lazy. So from here on out, I'm calling those just cuts, like a movie, like I'm editing a movie or a movie edit, you know, cut to Doc and Para. Now, cut to Doc and Para, the PI lady, coming out of the elevator to the lobby. Doc has a radio and he's shouting to his boys, you know, who are in hot pursuit of the sniper. Then Para PI drops a bomb on Doc. when he tells her that the guy was a highly skilled shooter. Then why did he miss so damn much? I'm paraphrasing. But when she tells Doc this, he radios Long Tom, whatever his name is, I can't remember, and he tells him, hey, that guy could be leading you into a trap. Maybe he missed us on purpose. Did I mention Doc is a genius? That might have... Cut to a rural marsh road. Seriously, they're now in the boondocks among some marshes. Shooter guy got in a car and drove way the fuck out in the middle of nowhere. How many marshes are near New York, by the way? Well, I learned that there are marshes about 40 minutes away from New York in what is currently a conservatory in Rye, New York. But even more interesting is the neighborhood that borders both Brooklyn and Queens. According to UntappedCities.com, it's New York's post-apocalyptic wasteland. I won't go into much detail about it here, but I'll talk about it on the Patreon-only sister podcast to this one that I'm, for now, calling Elton's Podcrastination. You know, for now. Until you help me come up with a better one, better title. It's going to be a more loose format than this already raggedly formatted podcast. I'll be discussing all the extra stuff I ran into while researching this podcast, plus whatever we decide to get up to, you know, music or fucking, I don't know, movies, who knows. So if you want to hear about The Hole, that's the name of the neighborhood that most New Yorkers haven't been to, despite it, quote, hiding in plain sight, unquote, you'll have to become a contributor via Patreon, dear listener. Until then, we move on. Doc and the Fabulous Five. That's such a weird name for a bunch of constantly together straight guys. I mean, no matter what time they're in, there's going to be a good time, and it's going to be fucking fabulous. And goddamn bless them. Sorry, I keep going back to that. I think it would, I honestly do think it would be fucking awesome if Doc Savage and his Fabulous Five came out. Or is he part of the Fabulous Five? Is it Fabulous Five when all of them? I can't remember. But anyway, it'd be great if they came out not only as gay quasi-superheroes, but gay quasi-superhero characters that are the genesis of all superheroes that came after them. How fucking cool would that be? But that doesn't change the fact that Doc and his boys are in a heap of trouble in that old New York swamp hood. Dredging up trouble is what they're doing. I don't know what I'm doing right now. They're there because that's where the sniper drove to. He drove to a shack in the marshes. Everybody is keeping their distance from the shack until Doc arrives. He comes up with a plan to wait till it's dark and then kind of slow swim crawl underneath the shack, you know, through the weeds and the marsh. It's like a swamp. And then the shack, which is on stilts, with a pier leading up to it, he wedges a two-way radio from underneath the floor. Like he swims up there and puts a radio right underneath their floorboards so he can listen in to the oddly spoken out word planning of the two guys inside. They're going to, quote, turn a devil loose once Doc and the Fabulous Five show up. How will we know they're here? One guy asks aloud. We'll know them by the sound of their fabulous, goddammit. Don't you know anything? That's not what happened, but they say something about turning a devil loose. That's real. That happened. Doc swim crawls back to the waiting Fab and tells them what the bad guys said. Rennie thinks all that devil shit is just weird figure of speech stuff, because they haven't encountered the Black Rock stuff yet. And while Doc thinks, he says, no, shit's about to get real, boys. And real it does. Doc yammers some shit into the radio, freaking the fucking bad guys out. And then they jump into a canoe and they glide away to set off the devil's black cock. It makes the ground shake and all the shit usually associated with big-ass explosions. Cut to 44th Street, just west of Broadway, New York City. Because why the fuck not, right? The two guys that set off the cock explosion are hitting the town, checking it out. I don't know, shows or something. It was the 1940s or thereabouts. So, like, So some nudie fan shows, or maybe discovering a place that sells even cheaper than 40-cent photos of women. Bring the kids! Anyway, they're walking down the street and they run into a crowd gathered around two guys on the sidewalk putting on a quiz show. One of the bad guys gets a box of cigars shoved in his arms, and he's pulled up to the microphone, and he's told that everyone else has gotten the question wrong, but if he gets it right, he wins a prize. Does he want to play? Sure, he says. The showrunner asks, have you ever tasted a better dick than mine? And the guy says, ew, no! To which the showrunner replies, well, hell, man, thanks for the compliment. Yeah, no. He asked him some shit about a branding iron, and the guy, being a criminal cowboy type from Arizona, knew the right answer. So they gave him a radio that suspiciously didn't come with batteries. The reason? It was to act like a listening device bug type thing. It wasn't an actual functioning radio. The guys giving him the radio were none other than two members of Doc Savage's fabulous crew. The two dastardly bastards go back to their bad guy hideaway on the 23rd floor of some fucking building or another. Who is there waiting to hear the news of Doc and his friends biting the big one courtesy of the big devil's black cock but Wickard, thinly veiled name Cole? They affirm that the bomb thing went off and left nothing but a giant hole where the marshy shack was. Then they start talking about Wickard's plan to demonstrate the devil's black rock by using it to kill 40 people the next day. No big whoops. Doc hears this and figures that it's time for him and his feisty fab friend to kick Wickard in his thinly veiled balls. They track down the building. Doc says he'll go up first to check things out and then signal for the other guys when he's ready. He gets to the 23rd floor and signals. Immediately after that, a guy pulls a gun on him and the elevator gets stopped with his fabuloso buddies stuck inside. Doc takes a few rounds to the chest, but luckily he has a bulletproof vest on that he invented. That's right, he invented the bulletproof vest, motherfuckers, that he always has under his shirt, which is constantly getting ripped off his body and shredded. Did I mention that? Doc is constantly getting his shirt shredded, which of course reveals how fucking shredded he is. I'm not kidding, people. Go check out Doc Savage novel covers. Go Google that. It's like a torn shirt fashion show. You won't be disappointed, though most of the shirts are beige. So, Doc's been shot. His friends are stuck in an elevator between floors. What's a plot to do but get old Savage back in the fight, which he does by handily knocking the gun out of the nameless bad guy's hand. It's at this time that he's confronted with two vicious dogs. With additional metal jaws on their faces, which are sharp. It mentions that specifically, that are also poisoned. Yep. I wish I was joking, but like the Lester Dent formula that I explained at length in the Patreon-exclusive extended episode of Part 1 explains, always makes it worse for the protagonist. This book can be exhausting. Oh, let me take a moment to shine some light on the writing. It's something to behold. If you listen to the first part of the Doc Stravaganza, I mentioned that Lester Dent, a.k.a. Kenneth Robeson, would crack off novels in one go with no editing. Well, that's probably not the flex he thought it was. Let me quote from the book here so you can see what I mean. This is a bit from the part where the dogs are attacking Doc in the hallway of the apartment/hotel place or whatever where the bad guys are staying. Quote, both dogs made for him. Doc followed the opening door into the room, followed it hard. He expected a man to be hiding behind the door. There was, and a fellow squawked as the door smacked against him. The two mad dogs came through the door like bullets. One of them tumbled over and over, trying to stop. Across the room, a second man stood trying to shoot Doc with an automatic. Apparently, he had forgotten to take the thumb safety off the automatic. Doc jumped out of the room into the hall and yanked the door shut again. In the room, the men began to make terror-stricken noises. The dogs made sounds, too. Unquote. Okay, there's a lot to unpack here. Okay, first, how many times do you need to say the word door? Isn't there a rule about repetitive uses of one word that not only not doing it four fucking times in one paragraph, plus automatic? Like, what the fuck is going on with tossing that in there, Lester Dent? Were you so hopped up on hash and amphetamines that you didn't know you just wrote the same fucking word in the previous sentence? Holy shit, does this happen a lot in this story. Here's another one, which is both annoying. Here's another one, which is both annoying and hysterical for a reason you'll hear at the end. A little context. Doc and this bad guy are in the elevator shaft, and the cables they're talking about are attached to the elevator currently occupied by Doc's buddies. So they're in the elevator shafts, they're fighting or whatever, and the henchman guy has been trying to bust the cables loose with a sledgehammer and has given up, and he tries to bail on the situation by jumping into the other shaft and grabbing the cables, you know, before Doc gets his hands on his fucking ass, and he's gonna fuck him up. So we go to this, and this is a direct quote. Quote, "The man wheeled, took a flying leap for the cables in the adjacent shaft. In doing that, his theory was excellent. He could slide down them to safety. His theory was indeed excellent. Practical execution of the hair-raising thing was something else. He got the cables all right, both arms and legs around them. He went down. By the time he got to the bottom, he was doing a good 150 miles an hour. He screamed horribly during at least half of the fall." So, what the fuck? On to the next most interesting part. Before that, it's mentioned that Doc withholds evidence, by the way. It's mentioned in there from the police that someone... That Doc has a special police commission, so he can withhold evidence. So it's all right. He has a special police commission. What the shit? It's not how that works. Anyway, now... The Fabulous Five and Tagalongs have almost been killed. A lot. So the whole crew, along with the newly acquired Donkey Sam, head back to Doc's place to regroup and ponder the legality of obstructing justice and a police investigation when suddenly a bullet gets lodged in the window of his penthouse lab up in the sky. Yep, that's what happens. Why didn't it shatter the window and make its way through the skull of someone in Doc's lab pad? You know, why didn't it just blow the brains out? Well, because he's got bulletproof glass in the windows of his high-rise penthouse on the 86th floor of the probably Empire State Building. That's why. Why wouldn't he have bulletproof windows in the highest building in the world? When you got the cash, you ought as well splurge a little with the extras that you absolutely never never need. Then another series of bullets hits the window, louder than the first. So Doc and his band of brotherly love wander over to the look out the windows as they're being shot at. Kind of a... Who could be shooting at us at this time of day? Kind of curiosity, you know, looking out the window across the way. Suddenly the telephone rings. William Harper Johnny Little John answers it and tells Doc that the people on the phone say they'll blow up the top of the building next, or something like that. To which Doc responds with a crisp, "Tell that motherfucker to go and fuck his mother. He can suck my dick in a non-sexual way." The guys threatening Doc and the crew threaten to fire a cannon at them. Not even kidding. And then they do. And then it smashes through the bulletproof window and buries itself in the ceiling of the room, exploding without much force. Did you hear what I just said? A cannon fires a shell into an apartment lab thing on the 88th floor of a building. Fires it through bulletproof glass and it explodes without much force. You would think any explosion of any kind of force would be bad, but... I'm just a scared little post 9/11 human being. I guess explosion in buildings back then, you know, to post World War II vets, they barely raised an eyebrow.
Is everyone that hasn't been repeatedly involved in violent traumatic events okay? Asked Doc in a semi-concerned, obligatory kind of way. The rest of the Fabulous Five guys gave a round of blithe, dismissive smirks and commentary peppered with things like, whatever, and nothing new, and it barely registered. While Donkey Sam, dazed, stared off into the middle distance, intermittently twitching, and Para Summers threw up in a nearby waste paper basket. Long Tom interrupted the sounds of her heaving. I guess we should go get those cannon guys, the rest of the team grumbled. Para, who had finished throwing up, was now exasperatedly hanging on the waste paper basket, quietly sobbing in the after effects of just having a shell go off and explode next to her.
What's her problem? Ain't she never been shot at before?
Rennie asked aloud. I don't get it either, answered Doc. I think it has something to do with her being a woman. I really do not understand them. He walked over to Para. Why are you crying, woman? It was only a moderately large indoor explosion caused by people who want to kill us, he asked loudly. Her crying increased. Long Tom snidely added,
maybe she needs a hug.
Rennie remarked,
maybe I need a hug first.
Long Tom answered him, fine, you freaking baby. The men embraced, which led to an exchange of kisses and then a makeout session. Monk spoke up.
Guys, come on. We have to get those guys with the cannon.
Doc interjected. Let them have their time. We know where the people are. Monk rolled his eyes.
Come on, Doc. If I had a dollar for every time these two got hot and heavy over some indoor apartment explosion, I'd have $1,000.
Just then, another window exploded inward. Everyone turned but Rennie and Long Tom, who continued to make out. Private Eugene Stoneblood Dollard swung through it, rolled across the floor, and quickly bound to his feet. He stood a few feet away from the group, his fist clenched, ready to engage in battle. Everyone was shocked by Private Dollar's entrance and was now frozen in confusion. Rennie and Tom continued to kiss, not acknowledging their uninvited visitor. And it got heavier. Dollar surveyed the devastated apartment and upon seeing the men making out, softened his demeanor, unsure of how to proceed. Doc, who had tensed when the glass broke, now eased his body at seeing Private Dollar ease his stance.
Can I help you, sir?
Stoneblood's eyes moved from one person to the next before settling on the two men who were now heavily petting and still kissing. Doc stepped toward Dollar.
Sir?
He asked. Dollar's face belied his perplexity. He both slightly shook his head and indicated no, and waved Doc off with his hand. Then, after looking at the men making out a little more, a puzzled look took hold on his face for a few seconds more as he made his way out the door, crunching broken glass under his feet, shaking his head in confusion.
Yeah, you know.
I'll stop apologizing. Look, if you're confused, listen to Hitler's Holy Relics episode. That'll bring you up to speed.
So no making out.
Along with all the other miracles taking place around this cannon firing episode, no one is killed.
Ah, the lovely safe world of overly violent fiction. The rest of the story after that wraps up with some bullets flying during a car chase, a little she's a twin plot twisting action, and a lot of bullets ending up in bad guy thug types. Oh, and so many punches. It's ridiculous. Then the Devil's Black Cock slaps around a few more folks that surprise the people that want to buy it from Wickard Cole. That's actually his big plan. He wants to sell it to, turns out, to be Nazis. Always, 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 always the fucking Nazis. Still, I'm not giving it all to you. You have to see how they get there. It is wild. So, it's good. These Doc Savage stories, there was four of them in this novel. They were good.
for the most part, despite the shit I've been giving them, they're fun to read. They're just fun. So it's like dessert. So I'll leave a link to this book that I read, and another by David Avalone, who is continuing to write Doc Savage stories and building on the legend of Doc and his badass team. You should definitely buy his book. It looks pretty good. It really does. I haven't gotten it yet, but I'm getting it. And this is kind of loosely related to right here. But after reading these Doc Savage stories, I happened to watch Live Free or Die Hard, the much unneeded sequel to Die Hard. One of them, anyway. In it, an aged, just old John McClane is reluctantly tasked with helping save the United States / world from a hacker terrorist insane money plot thing. Although I've known for years that Doc Savage on the brain. Although I've known for years that, you know, Die Hard and the action hero genre and movies and such, there's a pattern to it. Like, you know, the plot lines and stuff are, they have a fairly predictable formula. It never occurred to me that it might have an origin, you know, though, yeah, I'm probably way off. And the formula for action, the action hero's genre probably dates back to some fucking Greek theater play written by a guy who died thousands of years ago. I guess. Maybe. I don't know. But it's weird how similar it is to the Doc Savage story setup. The formula used for that, like plot points and stuff. They're real similar. Jesus fuck. I mean, even down to the bad plot hole filling writing too, and kind of piling ever more shit on John McClane. At one point in that fucking movie, he's being shot at by a fucking helicopter while he's trying to get away from it and avoid it in a tractor trailer on a freeway that's also falling apart. I mean, and then when you're basically trying to save the world from financial ruin and terrorism and all that, and save your daughter from Timothy Oliphant, you can't tell me that the man needs more on his plate. I mean, it's nice, but if it is related, if that is like a lineage from Lester Dent's writing formula to Doc Savage, and then it just kept going all the way to Die Hard, you know, if that... it. And even the Doc Savage character himself obviously inspired so many, like, the superheroes of today. It's nice to know that Doc Savage's legacy lives on in till even today in those fucking Die Hard movies. My God, in every Rambo movies, all of it, like it still echoes to today. And that he was gay, possibly. I mean, I know I kept going back to that, but how cool would that fucking be? You know what I mean? If all of them went back to... Anyway, I almost forgot, too. Have you been thinking about your oath that I asked about at the beginning of the part one of this whole shenanigans stuff? I have. I've been thinking of it, kind of. It's not nearly as deep or dramatic as Doc's, tell you that. To tell you the truth, I'm not even sure it qualifies as an oath. Maybe instead it's just it's kind of like a good reminder to myself, maybe, or just I don't know. It goes something like this. Try to be kind, quiet, honest, and thoughtful. Even if you fail at that, at least try and aim for what seems to be the most right for the most people. And if it's only one person you're dealing with, do the most right by them first, yourself second. Except when it means someone might get hurt. Then just try not to do it at all. You know. Above all else, in a world full of people, let someone else go first sometimes, even if it might be inconvenient. Oh, and hold the door open for people. Unless they're 10 feet away or more, then it's just an embarrassing waste of time for everyone involved. Thank you for listening to Elton Reads a Book a Week. I hope you enjoyed listening to this as much as I like making it. I really do like Mega. Remember to follow the podcast on the social media stuff so you can find out when one of these goes up. It seems like apps like to keep that information close to the chest for some reason. So the more you follow, the more likely you'll hear about it. If you really liked it, consider contributing on Patreon or through the anchor.fm page for this podcast. You'll get a bonus podcast, and we can talk to each other. And you can curse at me and I don't know, fucking video chat. I don't know how it works. We can do stuff together. And we can, you know, team up to build this whole podcast world out a little bit. Make it more lively and crazy, you know. We can have fun. If you're not in a position to do the Patreon thing, you can still help out by leaving a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple, Google. Take a little time out and do me a favor. You know what I'm saying? And leave a 5-star review. You know, wherever you get your podcasts, that helps. Even on Good Pods or, I don't know, one of the many places that shits out all the podcasts so you can, you know, that you can fucking listen to them or, you know, apps and such. What helps the most above all that else, above all that else? What the hell am I even saying now? My fucking brain is mush. What does actually help the most is word of mouth. So tell folks about it. You know, it really is. It's crazy helpful. The word of mouth is always good. So tell people about it. It's you know, it really does help. Above all else, from me to you, thank you. Thank you very much for listening. And please, thank you. And try and read a book this week. Maybe even a Doc Savage book, huh? Buy the, you know, the links into the description there, you know. But read a book. You know, don't let them die out. Thank you. Bye.